Hi, I'm Jake Silverstein, editor of Texas Monthly. Welcome to the Tribcast. If you ever have any objections to things that you read on Berkablog at texasmonthly.com, you should know that any inaccuracies or offensive statements contained therein are based entirely on misinformation gleaned from listening to the Tribcast. Nevertheless, here's your Tribcast crew.
Thanks, Jake. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the third week of February. Joining me is CEO Evan Smith.
I'm pleased to be back on the podcast, but if you had told me that Jake was going to do the intro, I would have objected. Because, well, you know, he did you hear him on the podcast when you were on that folk singer cruise?
I didn't hear him a lot. He was not the most loquacious on the podcast, but it's tough competition, I think.
He was terrible.
I thought he was very good.
He was terrible.
I thought what he said was short but meaningful.
It was shameful. He was terrible.
Reeve has a future to protect.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, someday, you know.
Don't quit your day job is my sense to Jake. There's,
well, it's a pretty good day job if you can get it.
Confidential to Jake. Introduce Brandy.
Julian Aguilar is also joining us.
Hello.
And so is, I want the tension to build, but Brandy Grissom is also here.
Hello.
She will be providing your obligatory depression at the end of the Tribcast.
I bring in a little sunshine.
Yeah. But before we get to Brandy's topic, we're going to talk about some political news, movings and shakings, both. And then we'll talk about Obama's budget and what it means for the border. But let's start with what used to be our favorite topic, although we don't necessarily.
It was our only topic for a long time.
Yeah.
By mandate, it was our only topic.
So if you can't guess what that is, we'll just tell you it's Perry's presidential aspirations.
Right. Reluctant to allow the moment to pass.
Right. He told someone this week.
Jonathan Carl of ABC News.
Yeah. I didn't want to be too specific, but he told Jonathan Carl of ABC News,
you know,
that he.
Props to Carl.
He absolutely might run for president again sometime. Evan. Do you believe him?
Well, he specifically said 2016, and I think it was interesting that he said, I might run again in 2016, which means that he thinks that the Republicans are going to lose, because the theory is he wouldn't challenge an incumbent Republican president in the primary, so Perry is already predicting an Obama victory. I mean, I'll just put that out there, right?
Is he also predicting a victory for his own gubernatorial bid in before that?
I don't think he's said that he's going to run again in 2014, and I think that you won't find five people in the Capitol who believe that the governor is going to run again. Maybe Burka.
So he doesn't have to run again to be a viable presidential candidate in 2016.
No,
I guess
think,
he never
I,
said
I,
he was going to be a viable
I don't,
presidential
I don't
candidate
think
in 2016.
He does. You know, you've got a number of people who are the two front runners right now in the Republican field are people who are not in office currently. They're former governor and former senator. Now, you'd be former governor. He could actually spend the period of time between January of 2015 and the election in 2016 out campaigning full time without pretending to be back here running the state, right?
I mean, yeah,
if that were the case. Look, he said he was the Tim Tebow of the race. He is the Jeremy Lin of the next race. How about that?
So you think Perry's going to get a degree from Harvard?
No, I just wanted to mention Jeremy Lin. In fact, there's no basis for my having said that at all. I just thought anything that mentions Jeremy Lin these days is awesome. So I thought just mention. No, look, Perry's assumption here, a couple things. Republicans.
We should have Jeremy Lin do
the intro, actually. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
When he comes down to play the Spurs.
You're throwing me off just imagining the awesomeness of that possibility. I'm now stunningly inarticulate for.
Well, if anyone can make it happen, it's me.
It is, in fact, you. Because you work so hard at everything. Exactly. So the first thing Perry's assuming is that there's no Republican in office. The second thing he's assuming is that people forget the 5.5 months in which he ran for president the first time. I mean, you really have to assume that the do-over button can be hit if he's going to run again. But look, this is a country that likes second chances. And, you know, it wasn't going to work for him this time. But, you know, he goes away, does a good job in the next 3 years. The state of the world is such that he thinks he's got a shot. If it's an open seat, Obama finishes a second term, and there's a scrum for who gets to be the Democratic nominee. Hillary doesn't run, so you've got the governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley. You've got Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. You've got, you know, various Mayor Villaraigosa. Is that his name? Villaraigosa?
In L.A.,
who's now going to chair the Democratic convention in North Carolina. It was reported last night emphasizing how important the Hispanic vote's going to be to Obama, we think.
You're not going to throw a bone to Julian Castro?
You know, there is a rumor that Julian Aguilar, the good Julian, as we refer to him.
The nice one.
And I have discussed that Julian Castro might be the Democratic...
At the DNC?
Keynote speaker at the DNC.
He was in the running, so to speak.
We've asked about it, and the response has been, you know, who knows. But you could argue, just as Ann Richards was a prominent figure as a consequence of her keynote speech in the 88 convention, as Barack Obama was a prominent national figure as a consequence of 2004, you could see how the Democrats would put Julian Castro up there and emphasize both the importance of the Hispanic vote, but also the mayor of the fastest growing city on a percentage basis over the last 10 years, where they're creating jobs and doing a lot of things that successful mayor. I mean, you could see the argument where they'd put him in front up, but we've digressed. The reality is that Perry, if he's looking
if we
at
have.
A, well, I have fine. If we're looking at an open race in 2016, you know, why the hell not?
So, because it went really badly in 2011, 2012.
So if that's what his plans are, how does he govern this next session? I mean, does he go a little bit more to the middle on immigration policy?
Well, he does what he did in 2011. I think all the while anticipating a race, even though he kept denying that he was going to run. You know, he did a lot in the legislative session. It is said that set him up for a national race. Look, Bill Clinton gave that awful speech at the convention in 88 that went on and on and on and on to the point that it was a joke. It was a joke. He came back and ran and won.
You're in the crib?
People forget that Barack Obama ran against Bobby Rush for the Democratic nomination for Congress. Rush, the former Black Panther, who was an incumbent congressman in Illinois in 2000 and got beat 2-1 in the primary. Losing is not a deal killer, right? In some ways, it's a precondition to running a better race the second time.
Well, then he can make the case
maybe
that
Perry learns from the 5.5 months and they retool and they think about, well, what do we take away from this? And they put together a better campaign. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Well, and then if Romney loses, then he can say, well, you should have nominated me.
Well, if Romney loses, the entire party is going to say, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We put two moderate Republicans.
A phrase that they've really had success with.
Well, but I mean, think about it, though. Think about it. You put two moderate Republicans up in successive election cycles and try to win the conservative base, and the conservative base is not enthusiastic. The third time, how dumb are you? And so you think we're going to nominate somebody from the Rick Perry wing of the party, and so Perry thinks to himself, why not me? Now, the problem for Perry is, in 2016, a lot of the people who decided not to get in this time, the Paul Ryans and the Mitch Danielses and the Jeb Bushes and the Chris Christies and those people, Perry could be entering a much more accomplished and distinguished field as opposed to this bar scene from Star Wars he ran against this last time, which frankly is what it is. I think Republicans would even tell you that they do not have the best and the brightest running this time, and they're basically muddling toward what a lot of them will privately tell you is a likely Obama victory. I'm skeptical about whether the election would be anything other than close in the fall under any circumstances. But a lot of Republicans feel like this is not a strong field, to say the least. And Perry did not fare well against a weak field. So the question is, how would he fare against a strong field?
So speaking of that bar scene from Star Wars, we were talking a little bit earlier this morning about how the date of the primary might affect the Santorum Mitt Romney battle here in Texas. Right. And I'm interested to know your thoughts about how the date really does affect that.
Well, Chuck Todd tweeted this morning that if the primary in Texas is in fact in June, say, dissatisfaction with the current crop of candidates and a fractured Republican field that is pointing toward a brokered convention could be an opportunity for one of these people I've mentioned, who is reluctantly drafted to come in and save the Republicans from certain defeat, to come in off the sidelines, get on the ballot, win a significant state and a block of delegates, and position him or herself to go into the convention as an alternative in a brokered convention scenario. This is Chuck Todd's theory. I mean, it's fantastical. All of us in the press dream about a brokered convention. It's, you know, because we're all bored.
And conventions are kind of boring.
Conventions are themselves boring. I actually think that Santorum is – we'll have a something to say about this from the standpoint of our polling at some point soon without going into specifics. And I'll be curious to see what our finding is about the Republican field in Texas. I think it is likely that a Santorum-type candidate would do well without knowing what our results are. I think it's likely that a Santorum-type conservative would do well in the Republican primary in Texas. Remember that in the last election cycle, in 08, John McCain was already the foregone conclusion as Republican nominee when the Texas primary rolled around on March 4th, and he only got 52% of the vote. Mike Huckabee, who was basically out of it at that point, who was the conservative alternative to McCain, got a third of the vote despite the fact that he was not going to be the nominee. Texans will not warm, I think, to a Massachusetts moderate, to quote Gingrich. And remember that the Perry people have all sort of jumped on the Gingrich train. So there's not a lot of enthusiasm within the Republican Party, I would suspect, for Romney in Texas. And I think depending upon the date of the primary, it could be a good thing for Santorum. If it's earlier and he was able to win Texas, it would be another argument in favor of Romney can't be the guy.
Of course, the specific date of the primary is still sort of up in the air, and I think Ross Ramsey, our executive editor, has been down there sitting on a wooden
embedded
bench just waiting for them to
finish. He's actually live-tweeting it, but from a booth at El Mirador. He's actually got a little got an earpiece. He figures, if I'm going to be in San Antonio anyway, right, may as well get some potato flautas. So it shouldn't be a total loss.
Well, I want to talk about some other developments that also might affect some races in Texas, which is this new super PAC that Leo Lindbeck has created, which is sort of an interesting idea. Where they are just going to attack incumbents on all sides. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on that, and if it was a worthwhile endeavor.
You've got two El Paso people here knowledgeable about El Paso. One of the places that the Lindbeck Super PAC is targeting is El Paso specifically. They're going after Silver.
Yeah, Brandy and I were talking about this yesterday. That Beto O'Rourke, who's challenging Congressman Reyes, is seen as the the more progressive, the sort of, the younger Democrat in El Paso. But the press releases and the backlash from the super PAC have been mainly from the Democrats, from the El Paso County Democratic chairman and from the El Paso Young Democrats that are just coming out in full force saying this is, a GOP sort of operation that's looking to unseat, it's looking to pretty much swing the election. So, Brandy, what are your thoughts? I mean, you covered the announcement when Beto, said he was going to try to unseat Silver. What do you think?
I think the money issue is a big question because Beto had a pretty good showing the last quarter, although he's still behind. That he did better in the last quarter, and so now you've got all this big money coming in from his father-in-law and other people who support his father-in-law as a developer out there. So, I mean, for him,
his father-in-law is given to this super PAC. What is it called? Anyone know the name off the top of their head?
It's Campaign for
Eliminating incumbents or something.
Awesome, awesome fundraising. I don't know what it's called.
The Leo PAC.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. So he's given money to that.
And all of his father-in-law's friends have given money to that. So, for him, in terms of funding, it's great. But it turns out maybe the messaging isn't so great. And I think that's sort of an interesting thing about El Paso, right? Because there's this idea of la gente and the people, and the more you can sort of paint yourself as a member of the sort of working class of El Paso, the better off you are politically there. And so Reyes has always been very strong in that category. He was a border patrol chief. He's not sort of super wealthy. He comes from a family, a farming family.
He's from Canutia. He's from outside of the El Paso establishment, right?
Ten brothers and sisters, whereas, Beto comes from a fairly well-off family. He went to Columbia. He's sort of seen as the upper crust. And sort of, it's part of that battle between the progressive and the establishment, so.
Or as Silver likes to call him, Robert O'Rourke.
Right, Robert.
This is like George H.W. Bush calling Pete DuPont Pierre, right? It's sort of the same. But my question, though, is the O'Rourke wing of the Democratic Party is the Shapley wing of the Democratic Party, is it not?
Well,
aren't Elliot and Beto ideological brethren?
Sort of. Although I think that Beto's been sort of around long enough now that he
is Elliot endorsed?
His own person. I haven't seen Elliot endorsed.
Aren't the Byrds, Bobby and Lee and Susie Byrd, supporting Beto?
Yeah, sure. It's that whole Veronica Escobar. Uh-huh.
What former state rep Norma Chavez calls the Veronicans. and the Shapley at
County Judge Veronica Escobar.
Do you think Shapley's going to endorse? My impression is that he's sort of done with politics.
He's been traveling. I think the issue, though, is that there is a real divide in El Paso between the sort of the progressive wing of the party, which is embodied by the sort of Shapley Byrd view of things. On the one hand, Silver is more of a conservative Democrat, small C conservative,
right.
And I think that's an interesting split. And of course, in El Paso, in this congressional district, you know, spring equals fall as far as the election goes. The primary will ultimately be the general. The winner of the primary will be the member of Congress.
Sure.
It's, you know, the other thing that's great is, of course, so it's this Lindbeck pack. So who else is a big contributor to this Lindbeck pack? Tim Dunn, who's the money behind the Michael Quinn Sullivan empire, you know, the Midland oil man, very conservative. The people who've contributed to this pack, you know, it's interesting. And so that, I'm Leo claims we're not in this for party. It's not about Republican or Democrat. And, you know, they're going after apparently Eddie Bernice Johnson as well in her race against Barbara
Mallory Caraway.
Well, and they do have some criteria, right? They won't go after first termers or second termers. So you have to have been in there for a while. And I think you have to meet a threshold of low enough approval ratings. Is that right?
I think that's right.
But, you know, it sort of does beg the question, is an incumbency inherently a bad thing? You might have someone that's, is someone misrepresenting El Paso just because they've been representing El Paso for a long time? Sort of a throw the bums out mentality.
There's an assumption that if you stay in office for too long, that you don't gain the benefit of experience, you gain the drawback
and the trappings.
You know, I've been in this office for a long time. It's about me. It's not about the people I represent. I only care about that. The minute I get elected, I start fundraising again for the next time, and the focus becomes on keeping my own job. But, you know, the thing about Reyes is they know what they're getting with him.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And Reyes has been chair of the House Intelligence Committee. It's not as if he's been a backbencher. He's been a consequential member of the House. You know.
Okay, well, it's an interesting development in the political money world. Well, yes. I guess we'll see what happens with it. But El Paso's on the border. Let's talk about the border. How's that for a transition?
That was pretty good.
Very smooth.
Yeah, that was smooth.
You have a story this morning. This morning is Wednesday morning. Unless you listen to it some other time, but we are talking on Wednesday morning.
We are.
Sort of talking about what Obama's budget means for the border. It's not likely to make him a lot of friends along there, it sounds like.
No, for two key issues. The Texas Border Coalition is a group of business interests and border mayors and whatnot. They are upset because there is no additional funding for port infrastructure, which they say is essential to keeping this robust trade partnership with Mexico, or staffing. Speaking to the subcommittee on immigration chairwoman, Monica Weisberg-Stewart, she says that a lot of people out there don't know the difference between CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and U.S. Border Patrol. Whereas Border Patrol keeps getting funded, CBP needs more staffing, and CBP are the ladies and gentlemen in blue that, you know, check your cars and, you know, process all the trade. So there's nothing in there for that, and they're pretty upset about that. They're saying, look, you know, he's turning his back on us again. And this started in 2008 when Napolitano secured a bunch of funding for the port at Nogales, Arizona, and a lot of folks said, well, it's because she's from Arizona, so she's giving them preferential treatment. That border port is not as busy as the three major ports in Texas. So that's kind of where it started, and they've been beating this drum for a really, really long time. And then the immigrants' rights community, is upset because this budget expands secure communities, which is this controversial initiative that runs fingerprints from anybody arrested in local jails and runs them against a federal database to see if these folks are deportable under immigration laws. It was touted as going after the main offenders, you know, the criminal aliens, but a lot of folks say it casts too wide a net. It's separating families, you know, on because somebody got pulled over and they have outstanding traffic tickets, you know. So that's actually expanded. In this budget, they want to expand it nationwide by the end of 2013. There's also some money in there to expand E-Verify, which actually, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike are a little against because they say it's not error-proof, that it could lead to false matches. So there's a lot in this, just this Homeland Security budget that's raising some eyebrows. It's still proposed. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, is testifying as we speak before the Appropriations Committee. She goes before Homeland Security later today. So there'll be a lot of folks. I'm sure Congressman Reyes, speaking of him, and Congressman Cuellar will have a lot to say about not only the port funding but the expansion of these immigrant programs.
Is there something that they would prefer money to be going to?
I think everybody on the border would like to see more money for the ports. That's a no-brainer. There's also a lot of in this budget that takes away from the Coast Guard, that takes away from a lot of current operations. I think a lot of people would like to see a lot more money in there. The Coast Guard is coming to play on the border because Congressman Cuellar wanted to have some Coast Guard patrolling the Rio Grande, where it's, you know, wide enough to actually have a boat, unlike El Paso, where it's, you know, just kind of a small little channel. So I don't think that's going to happen in this budget. And there's also, excuse me,
Yeah, I got choked up.
Talking about the budget. Also, the Obama budget had nothing for cough drops, actually. Totally zeroed out the cough drop line.
The one thing, actually, that the immigrants' rights groups have not said is that this program actually defunds by a significant amount the 287G program, which Brandy's pretty familiar with. That's another controversial program where law enforcement are trained as immigration officers. And but nothing's been said about that.
Why
and
is
I'm
that
sure,
controversial?
Because they say that their law enforcement, their peace officers, are not trained as immigration officers. You know, they might get something wrong. They might open them up to racial profiling. Just all sorts of problems.
But don't you think, Julian, that the president knows that whatever he does that might make the Hispanic community unhappy in this budget, he's going to run against a party
exactly
that has not exactly advertised itself as pro-Hispanic or friendly to Hispanics.
And we've talked
the
about
risks
this.
Are low for him in the fall.
We've written about this before. It's, you know, he can play the lesser of two evils angle because he can't go to El Paso and Laredo and say, hey, you know, reelect me. I've separated more families than, you know, since the Eisenhower administration with my immigration policies. But what he can say is, you want those guys? You want the party of electrical fences, and I'm the clear alternative. And he can also say, I haven't passed immigration reform because Congress won't let me. It's like, it's not all on me, you know. So
does the I'm just enforcing the laws argument not hold a lot of sway?
It depends, you know. If you ask the Republicans, they say he's selectively enforcing the laws, and this, you know, he's nitpicking. It's like a cafeteria buffet line. Like, he's choosing what parts of immigration policy he can enforce, or he wants to enforce, and other parts that he can't. So he's kind of stuck, you know. His administration has deported more people, you know, in decades. And the Republicans say, well, it's not enough. Or, well, you know, you have this discretion policy which lets, you know, undocumented immigrants stay here, and it's not fair. Then on the flip side, like we've just talked about, the immigrants community is saying, hey, wait a minute, you were the hope, you know, you were the hope for immigration reform. So he's kind of stuck in this limbo. Brandy, were you going to say something? Sorry.
Well, I'm curious about this whole issue of spending on the ports, because when I was covering border security and immigration, it was something that was a problem then too. But so, I mean, the argument, I guess, from the Border Coalition and other folks who want more spending on the ports is that actually this is where most of the drugs come into our country.
Sure.
So we've spent billions of dollars between the ports with fencing and with Border Patrol officers increasing boots on the ground and all of those things. But that's where drugs primarily come in, you know, backpacks, whereas at ports they come in semi-trucks.
Mm-hmm.
So how come they can't get this message across about the necessity of spending additional funds at ports? Why is that argument so hard to make?
I think because once you get away from the border, the people, you know, they think, you know, illegal smuggling and immigration. I mean, they see, you know, it's the night vision cameras of people between the ports. And when you see a picture of a port, you just see legitimate trade and whatnot. And that's also kind of, it's an interesting thing that you point out, because they're funding a new bridge out in El Paso County, in eastern El Paso County. They just opened another one up in McAllen. But I think what the Texas Border Coalition is arguing is that they need it now. Those bridges are being built. They might relieve some congestion. They might help trade and traffic in a couple of years. But they want this now because despite all the problems in Mexico, it's still, you know, one of the strongest economies in the nation. There's still, you know, manufacturing is up. And actually, the maquilas, they lost a lot of business, not because of the drug war that went on, but because the auto industry kind of plummeted. Now that's on the up and up again. So they're saying, look, we're missing a golden opportunity right now to fund the current ports instead of throwing money outside and constructing new ports. But going back to what you originally asked, it's not because they just think that the general public does not know. They just don't get the message, like, hey, legitimate trade also means that there's a bunch of stuff going through, because they see the news clips on, you know, the desert. And like I said, you know, people swimming across.
It's like a Hollywood thing, right? If you're going to film a scene of someone smuggling something, you're going to have them, like, crawling under a fence.
Exactly.
You're not
going to
have them just driving.
It's not as sexy to talk about, you know, pot coming through and
semi-trucks. I don't know. I think semi-trucks are sexy, personally.
Everybody get that?
Yeah. Well, we're going to go from that high note to let Brandy bring us down a little bit, I think. We're going to close this out with a little discussion about the rise of youth-on-youth violence in juvenile detention facilities, which, despite reforms, is going up.
Right.
Can you sort of explain the situation?
Sure. So what happened is in 2007, there were all these horrendous reports of sexual and physical abuse being perpetrated on some of the youths who were housed at Texas Youth Commission facilities across the state. And so what lawmakers did back in 2007 is they said, well, we're going to do a bunch of things to try to make these facilities safer. We're going to make sure that only felony offenders go to these institutions. We're going to close a bunch of them, and we're going to give local communities incentives to keep kids closer to their communities where they have more access to resources like rehabilitation, drug treatment, counseling, all those kinds of things, instead of in these facilities that are out in the boonies where staff isn't very well trained and it's hard to find people and those kinds of things. So the whole idea really was to make these institutions safer for the kids as well as for the staff. And so what you've seen as a result over the last 5 years is a dramatic decrease in the number of kids who are sent to TYC. So that's a big plus, right? You have fewer kids who are being locked up in these prison-like facilities across the state. And you've also seen a pretty good decrease, a dramatic decrease, in the sexual assaults of all kinds at those facilities. So to some degree, those reforms really are showing themselves to work. But what you are also seeing as a result is that more of these sort of felony offender, really tough kids are concentrated in a smaller number of facilities. And so it's, you know, I guess not really that big of a surprise that you would see these tough kids starting to pick on one another more. So they've weeded out some of the weaker kids who probably would have taken a lot of the brunt of the attacks before. And now you have these tough kids who are very aggressive in a smaller amount of space. And you have a staff who is still learning these new ways of dealing with kids. So the approach at TYC, which is now TJJD, used to be really focused on punitive measures and punishing kids when they acted out. And that's one of the reasons you saw the abuse. But now what you're seeing is a change, and they're trying to change the culture throughout TYC, or TJJD now, to be more focused on rehabilitation and getting kids to change their behavior. So instead of punishing them and, you know, in more physical ways, they're trying to change their behavior and talk to them about aggression replacement and those kinds of things. So those are kind of
This is not as much changes. Of a downer as I thought. I feel bad for misleading the audience.
Not for the first time.
Well, let's give her a moment. What about the assaults from staff on the inmates, for lack of a better term?
Attacks on staff?
From staff members onto
Those are down, too. So physical violence from staff to kids, down. Physical violence from kids to kids, way up. Physical violence from kids to staff, way up.
How about staff on staff violence?
You know, they didn't report that much. Oh, I'd be interested to see those numbers.
Weeded out the weaker staff?
I don't know.
So is this being seen in the criminal justice community as a success with some perhaps unanticipated issues that need to be dealt with, or is it sort of a failure because now you have all this violence going on?
I don't think that...
Those are your only two options. Success or failure.
You must pick right now. Yeah.
Nobody I talked to said, oh my gosh, this is a huge failure. But they said clearly there is more work to be done here, because how safe are these institutions if the rate of attacks among youths has skyrocketed by triple since over the last 5 years? And you know, one of the places you see it most is at Giddings, where staff seems to be clearly struggling with how to deal with these kids. Last year alone, they had 216 incidents where they used pepper spray. And that was up from like 45 the year before.
If I could do math, I would tell you what percentage increase that was. It sounds like a lot.
It's big.
Yeah. Well, you know, we often, each week we take the strongest members of the Tribune and bring them into this little closet to record this thing. And we managed to not fight each other too much.
Quite honestly, if I knew pepper spraying you was an option, I would have done it a year ago.
Those would have been way up, you know, for last year or this year.
All right. Well,
staff on re-violence, way up, actually, according to the report.
If you'd like to report any incidents or have any questions or comments, please email Texas. No, don't email that. Email tripcast@texastribune.org.
You've only been doing this for a year. Next week, I'm going to hit you over the head with Todd's gourd.
I've been gone for 2 weeks. Tripcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Brandy, Julian, And our producer, Todd. I am Reeve.
And our special guest, intern Paul.
And intern Paul has, you know, he's been quiet this whole time.
He's
but
been
he's been in the room, and he his presence has been felt, definitely. So on behalf of Paul, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Colgate, you suck.